Let us begin by first positioning the Book of Esther in its historical context. Israel entered into captivity with Babylon between the years 605 and 582 BC. There were several rounds of exiles through Nebuchadnezzar's reign. Later, with the fall of Babylon in 539 BC to Cyrus the Great of Persia, the Jews were allowed to begin returning to their homeland. Cyrus has a special place in the history of the Jewish people thanks to his remarkable tolerance of varied religious beliefs and cultural traditions. Now here we encounter some historical questions about how to best reconcile the biblical account with the secular history. It is unclear if the Darius we know from Daniel and the Lion's Den is Cyrus or someone appointed by Cyrus or even Cyrus's father-in-law. Regardless, after the reign of Cyrus, we have the reigns of Cambyses, his son, Bardia, very briefly, Darius the First, who is assumed to have come along too late to be the Darius we know from Daniel, and then the son of Darius, Xerxes, who we also know as Ahasuerus from the story of Esther. Therefore, here, in a relatively short span of years, we have the tale of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego under Nebuchadnezzar, followed not long later by Daniel and the lions under Darius, and then possibly 60 to 80 years later comes the story of Esther. Many of the Jews that had been in captivity to Babylon were allowed to go home, but many stayed, due either to the convenience or an increased degree of religious tolerance. So we ask, why was this story preserved for us? It's a wonderful story, certainly. Neither Shakespeare nor Hollywood could have done a better job of adding in danger, plot twists, excitement. Of course, this is also an important event in the history of the Jews, as it leads to their Feast of Purim. And on top of this, we have some wonderful character lessons for ourselves. We read in Esther chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. Now it took place in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days, as King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was at the citadel in Susa, in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his princes and attendants, the army officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his provinces being in his presence. And he displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days, 180 days. The Medo-Persian Empire was huge. It ranged from India on the east to Ethiopia on the west. And Ahasuerus gave a banquet for all his princes and attendants over a period of 6 months. It's been suggested that this would not have been practical if all had attended at once. So perhaps there was a rotating group of attendants in order to allow the general running of the empire to continue without a nationwide interruption. It's further been suggested that the purpose of this banquet was to discuss the king's ill-fated desire to conquer Greece. Greece had previously repelled a takeover attempt by his father, Darius I. And history tells us that Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, would also fail in this. But in this account of his banquet, we learn something else important about the king. He had a great deal of pride and self-satisfaction in his office. As with many kings, he felt the need to ostentatiously show off his great wealth for all to see. And as our story progresses, we will see that he also is rather easily led by his advisors. After this extensive feast, he holds a smaller feast for all those present in his winter palace of Susa, or Shushan. A 7-day feast, including the royal wine, at the end of which we read, Esther 1, verses 10 through 12, on the 7th day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded the 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, delivered by the eunuchs. Then the king became very angry, and his wrath burned within him. You may recall how this plays out. The king's advisors tell him this cannot be tolerated. After all, if women start to disobey their husbands, who knows what kind of anarchy will occur. And so Vashti was permanently banished from the king's presence. We note here that the king is very quick to wrath. This is an important point to keep in mind and one we will revisit later. Then in Esther 2:1, we read, "After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her." It turns out that the king was likely absent from Persia for parts of 2 years during his assault on Greece. Upon returning home, you can imagine what happened. He flew into a rage and had said some things he regretted. It's a very human thing to do, but perhaps even more so a very Persian king thing to do. It's bad enough when any of us say things we regret to our spouse. But imagine when you're the king of the Medes and the Persians and your edicts are irrevocable. So now that he's returned to his home and his fit of temper is a long forgotten detail, he misses his wife. But there's nothing he can do about it. While I hardly think the point of this book is about the temper of Ahasuerus, I find the control of one's temper and the ability to repent of that temper to be very important and worth at least pointing out briefly. At the same time, we note that Vashti chose an interesting course of action. It's so easy to judge her actions in hindsight, of course, but surely she knew the temper of Ahasuerus and must have suspected things would not go well for her. Furthermore, it sounds like the king was drunk with wine, and I cannot imagine he was making a reasonable request, nor do I blame her for not wishing to display herself for all his princes and attendants. But Brother Russell makes a very interesting point in reprint 4900, where we read, "Many will say she did just right in asserting her womanhood, in standing up for her rights. We will not dispute that all women have rights and that Queen Vashti had hers and that she exercised them. We merely offer the suggestion that in a question of rights, along lines of force and compulsion, Queen Vashti won a victory which cost her dearly. In Queen Esther's procedure, which is the subject of this lesson, we see the opposite course pursued. The queen won a great victory with happy results by a totally different procedure, and one which in our judgment recommends itself to the wisest and best of men and women. Vashti could have taken a similar course, but did not. However much she might have felt that the king's requirement of her presence would expose her to jest or rudeness, she should have relied upon her charm and tact and purity and upon her husband's love and care. I don't wish to belabor this point, as I wouldn't claim it's the main intent of this book either, and yet it's always wise to consider our actions and their repercussions. Something that I have said numerous times as both a parent and a teacher is that when dealing with a superior, whether it be an adult, a teacher, your elder, it's always best to obey first and ask questions later. Perhaps things might have gone better for Vashti had she considered this. Of course, it all worked out exactly as the Lord intended. Now we come to this portion of the story where Vashti is replaced. With the king missing his wife, his advisors once again intervened. It seems they were very persuasive. And we read in Esther 2, verses 2 through 4, "Then the king's personal attendants suggested, 'Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. Let the king appoint emissaries in all the provinces of his realm to gather all beautiful young virgins into the harem in the royal precinct of Susa. Under the care of the royal eunuch Higai, guardian of the women, let cosmetics be given them. Then the young women, or the young woman who pleases the king shall reign in place of Vashti.' This suggestion pleased the king, and he acted accordingly." And here is where Esther enters the picture. She's living with her cousin Mordecai, as she no longer had a father or mother. According to Jewish tradition, Mordecai was a member of the Sanhedrin, and as such, well-educated in the law and in languages. One source suggests a knowledge of up to 70 tongues, which may also play a part in this story. If Mordecai was such a member, it is likely that Esther was raised in a very pious household and would have been well-educated in the Jewish laws and customs. When the many young ladies were gathered to Susa in the custody of Higai, Esther apparently made a favorable impression, as we read in Esther 2:9. "The young woman pleased him and won his favor, so he promptly furnished her with cosmetics and provisions. Then, choosing 7 maids for her from the royal palace, he transferred both her and her maids to the best place in the harem." Perhaps we already see the hand of the Lord working here. Esther is quickly set up as a favorite for the king's affection. based on the way things were done at the time, it's possible that Esther was only 15 years old when she was taken to Susa. Can you imagine the challenge for her to cope with being separated from her only family at such a young age? And on top of this, Mordecai instructed her to keep her heritage a secret. It's not clear what motivated this decision. Perhaps there was some sort of persecution going on at the time, or perhaps he was simply moved by the Holy Spirit. Whatever the case, she was successful in hiding her origins. Next, the young women gathered into Ahasuerus' harem. They underwent a full year of beauty treatments. Can you imagine? A full year. 365 days. We read in chapter 2, verses 12 through 16, after the 12 months preparation decreed for the women, each one went in turn to visit King Ahasuerus. During this period of beautifying treatment, 6 months were spent with oil of myrrh, and the other 6 months with perfumes and cosmetics. Then when each one was to visit the king, she was allowed to take with her from the harem to the royal palace whatever she chose. She would go in the evening and return in the morning to a second harem under the care of the royal eunuch Shashgaz, guardian of the concubines. She could not return to the king unless he was pleased with her and had her summoned by name. As for Esther, daughter of Abihail and adopted daughter of his nephew Mordecai, when her turn came to visit the king, she did not ask for anything but what the royal eunuch Higgai, guardian of the women, suggested. And she won the admiration of all who saw her. Esther was led to King Ahasuerus in his palace in the 10th month, Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. There are two points of interest here. In what manner did Esther approach the king, and how did she come to this decision? To begin with, imagine what a 15-year-old girl must be feeling at a time like this. On the one hand, she's undoubtedly nervous and uncertain, but then it's probably not an uncommon age to be married at that time, with rather shorter lifespans, and perhaps there is some excitement even because she might become queen. And I would further imagine there would be some contention amongst the contenders for the king's attentions. So picture in your mind a large group of possibly teenage girls all trying to get the attention of the king. When offered their choice of anything from the harem, each would certainly have tried to outdo the other with jewelry, perfume, and makeup. And now it's Esther's turn, and she talks to Higgai, the one in charge of all the concubines, and she just asks his advice humbly. And his advice is to go clothed in her natural beauty and to take nothing extra with her. So armed with her beauty and her youth, avoiding the distractions of excessive makeup and jewelry, is it any wonder that Esther stood out from the crowd? I suspect that Higgai knew exactly how the king would react. So what are some lessons for us in Esther's example? Certainly, to ask for guidance. To admit we don't have all the answers is a good start. As we read in Proverbs 3:7, do not be wise in your own eyes. And furthermore, Esther's unadorned and simple beauty is a wonderful picture of the simple beauty of our faith. Our faith needs no additions or subtractions, no perfumes or makeup to hide its blemishes. It stands on its own as exceptional. And when compared with all the others, it stands head and shoulders above the rest. Continuing with our story, after Esther becomes queen in the 7th year of the reign of Ahasuerus, we are told that Mordecai is sitting at the king's gate. Since the king's gate was the seat of day-to-day government, it can be inferred that Mordecai held some sort of position in the political structure at that time. His positioning here was another example of God's providence, as we see in Esther 2:21-23. During the time that Mordecai spent at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the royal eunuchs who guarded the entrance, became angry and plotted to assassinate King Ahasuerus. When the plot became known to Mordecai, he told Queen Esther, who in turn informed the king in Mordecai's name. The matter was investigated and verified, and both of them were impaled on stakes. This was written in the annals in the king's presence. There is some speculation about how Mordecai would have become privy to the plotting of two of the king's eunuchs. Some suggest they wouldn't have discussed such a plot openly. Others suggest they may have conversed in their native language, perhaps a foreign language, thinking that they were safe. However, this is where perhaps Mordecai's mastery of many languages may have led him an extra ability to ferret out this truth. Regardless, somehow he was able to convey knowledge of an assassination plot to the king through Esther. Perhaps most noteworthy in this instance is that all Mordecai got for his trouble was an annotation in the annals of the king. They took note of it. That's it. He saved the king's life, and his reward was barely a word of thanks. That might make some men bitter, but we have no record of any such reaction from Mordecai. And while it might only be a small lesson, I like this thought that when we do good to others, it should be with no thought to a reward for ourselves and no expectation of even a thank you. Do we ever feel we deserve recognition, or are we satisfied in ourselves? The next time you catch yourself feeling frustrated because of a lack of recognition, remember that the Lord sees it, and that is the most important thing. And returning to our story, we'll soon find that being written in the annals is not the same as being written off. The next stage in this story is where the tension really picks up. A number of years after his marriage to Esther, Ahasuerus promotes Haman the Agagite and places him in authority of all the princes who were with him. We aren't told more than that about just where Haman came from or how he rose through the ranks. But this illustrates yet again that Ahasuerus seems blind to the liabilities of his best advisors. And Haman has liabilities just like all the others. The first action we're told of regarding Haman is that the king commanded all to bow down and pay homage to him. You can read about this in Esther, the third chapter, the first six verses. We don't have time to read it all. But in summary, all were commanded to bow down to Haman, but despite this command, Mordecai did not. And when Haman observed that Mordecai would not kneel and bow down, he was filled with anger. And so they asked, "Why are you not bowing down to Haman?" And Mordecai's response was, "Because I'm a Jew." It's an interesting response. And so again, Mordecai's anger was kindled against him, and he thought it was beneath him to attack Mordecai. But since he found out about Mordecai's nationality, he decided to destroy all the Jews. So those first six verses, again, Esther, the third chapter, is a great passage for several reasons. To start with, why does the king have to command everyone to bow down to Haman? If Haman really was a worthy prince, wouldn't everyone bow down to him anyway? But perhaps he was a bit of an insecure individual, and he needed to feel important. And on top of this, Mordecai didn't bow down. That's kind of a peculiar action. Certainly you're just picking a fight by disobeying this order of the king. Why would he not bow down? Well, perhaps the answer to this and to Haman's response might lie in the ancestry of Mordecai and Haman. It turns out their bloodlines had perhaps been set against each other for many generations, for approximately 200 years. You see, if we read Esther 2:5, we read, "There was in the royal precinct of Susa a certain Jew named Mordecai, son of Jer, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjamite." Now let's compare 1 Samuel, 1 Samuel 9:1 and 1 Samuel 14:51. "There was a powerful man from Benjamin named Kish, who was the son of Abiel, son of Zeror, son of Becherath, son of Aphiah, a Benjamite." And Kish, in verse 51, Kish was the father of Saul. Now Kish is likely not a unique name, and there's a strong possibility that Mordecai is from the same bloodline as Saul, perhaps a great-great-great-great nephew of some sort. And furthermore, if we look at Haman the Agagite, and again looking in 1 Samuel 15, and for lack of time, I'm not going to read all these verses, but if you look at 1 Samuel 15, you find the incident where Samuel was supposed to go and attack Amalek, and he was supposed to kill all men and women, oxen and sheep, camels and donkeys, and you may recall that he didn't do as he was told. He took Agag, the king of Amalek, alive. And yet afterward, after they conquered this people, and after he thought he was going to take the best of the sheep and the cattle and Agag, Samuel comes along and says, "No, this is not what the Lord wanted," and he kills Agag. He hacks him to pieces. But this, you may recall, the whole incident is with Saul, that he was not obeying. And this is the famous line about it is better to obey than to sacrifice. But the important part we want to point out is it was Agag. And we are told that Haman is an Agagite. So this is the connection we're making. if Mordecai is a descendant from Saul and Haman is a descendant from Agag, then they have been against each other from 200 years ago when Saul was supposed to have killed Agag in the first place. So imagine you're Mordecai and Haman. Your ancestors are bitter enemies. Your great-great-great-great-uncle is responsible for destroying the nation and rulership of his great-great-great-great-grandfather. And the fact that your great-great-great-great-uncle foolishly showed mercy to his great-great-great-great-grandfather cost him his kingdom. So as Mordecai, are you going to bow down to this man who shouldn't even be alive today? And when they asked him why he wouldn't bow down, he said, I'm a Jew. And then they took this to Haman and said, hey, he won't bow down to you because he's a Jew. Well, what's Haman's reaction going to be? If he really is a descendant of Agag, he's going to be even angrier because he doesn't like the Jews that destroyed his great-great-great-great-grandfather. He would feel they destroyed his nation and wronged him and his family. And that leads us to that general lesson, again, in 1 Samuel 15:22, to obey is better than to sacrifice. For if Saul had taken care of business as he was directed all those years ago, Haman might not have even been in the picture to cause distress to the Jews in Persia at this time. But the Lord's purposes are so much deeper and interconnected than any of us can truly fathom. And this is why obedience is always the best course of action, even while our understanding is still developing. Whether or not these are his true motivations, Haman makes it his mission in life to wipe out not only Mordecai, but all of the Jews. We read in Esther 3, 7 through 11, in the first month, Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, the poor, or Lot, was cast in Haman's presence to determine the day and month for the destruction of Mordecai's people on a single day. And the lot fell on the 13th day of the 12th month, Adar. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, dispersed among the nations throughout the provinces of your kingdom, there is a certain people living apart. Their laws differ from those of every other people, and they don't obey the laws of the king. So it is not proper for the king to tolerate them. If it please the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them. And I will deliver to the procurators 10,000 silver talents for deposit in the royal treasury. The king took the signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. The king said to Haman, the silver is yours, as well as the people, to do with as you please. Thus, in his position of confidence to Ahasuerus, he is easily able to gain his ear, make a vague proposition. Notice he doesn't mention the Jews by name, but simply describes a vague threat to the laws of the empire. And he's able to bribe his way into getting an edict passed. For comparison, 10,000 talents of silver, by one estimate, is two-thirds of the annual revenue for the entire Medo-Persian Empire. He was offering a huge sum of money to destroy these people. Note also that Haman believes in fortune-telling as he casts lots to determine the best day to attack the Jews, which thankfully for the Jews was approximately a year away. That Pur, or Lot, by the way, mentioned above, in plural form is Purim, which is the origin of the Jewish feast of the same name, and their way of remembering the Lord's deliverance via Esther. And as the decree goes out across the land, Mordecai learns of it and quickly lets Esther know, as she is certainly the best hope for the Jews at this point. So let us once again put ourselves in Esther's shoes. We've had 5 years to grow accustomed to life as queen, but surely don't get to see our family anymore. Perhaps 20 years old, we're now faced with a crisis of greater scope than simply being forced to marry the king. Now our life and the lives of our entire people are at stake, and it's already been decreed by an edict of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be altered. What are we going to do? What can we do? This sounds like a job for a Saul or a David or a Gideon, not a 20-year-old girl. But Mordecai sends a message to Esther via her servant, ordering her to go to the king and plead for their people. And Esther's reply to Mordecai in Esther 4:11, all the servants of the king and the people of his provinces know that any man or woman who goes to the king in the inner court without being summoned is subject to the same law, death. Only if the king extends the golden scepter will such a person live. Now as for me, I have not been summoned to the king for over 30 days. So her response is, I can't do that. He could kill me. It's been 30 days. He might not even want to see me anymore. And from what we've read about the king, to find him fickle is not a surprise. And while I think we all understand the basic concept, it must have been dangerous to approach the king unsummoned, perhaps you, as I did, might think, well, come on, this is his wife. Surely he's a little more lenient to her. Well, Brother Russell shares in reprint 3656. reprint 3656, a story of the wrath of Xerxes, who we believe is Ahasuerus. The queen's answer was that Mordecai, as well as all the people, knew that if she or anyone else should attempt to go into the king's presence uninvited, it would mean their death, unless the king chanced to feel favorable to them and extended his golden scepter. She remarked also that evidently the king was not feeling very gracious toward her because he had not called her into his presence for more than a month. That her fears were not groundless is evident to those acquainted with the history of the time. For instance, it is recorded of this very king that when en route for a war, he rested at Olenae of Phrygia, where he was the guest of Pythias, who entertained him magnificently. But when the latter begged as a favor that of his five sons in the king's army, the eldest might be left with him in his old age, the brutal Xerxes, in a rage, caused that son to be slain in the presence of his father, the body divided into two parts, the one part placed on one side of the road, the other on the other side, and the whole army marched between them. And this is a supporter of the king. So we've already seen the wrath of Ahasuerus, and this serves to still further convince us he was very unpredictable and could fly into a rage with a little thing. So how can we blame a 20-year-old girl from hesitating to approach him? And yet, Mordecai, in Esther 4:13-17, has a perfect response. And I will summarize again for lack of time. But essentially, he says, if you stay quiet, God will find another answer. But you and your father's house will perish. Maybe the whole reason you're here is for this purpose right now. And so she replies, go pray for me, fast on my behalf. I will go to the king, and if I perish, I perish. I love both those responses. First of all, Mordecai points out that when you have an opportunity, you have to take advantage of it. Perhaps you're there precisely because God wants you there. And I just love the thought of this 20-year-old girl who recognizes what the right thing is to do. And she says, you're right, I'm going to do it. And if I perish, I perish. I think this is the largest and most obvious lesson of Esther. We must be aware of every opportunity to serve the Lord. Who is to say if we haven't been placed into some specific situation exactly because he wants us there to do his will? And certainly we see the Lord's hand in positioning Esther exactly where she needed to be to save the Jews. During one of our studies down in Portland, Brother Bruni Hack made a wonderful analogy, and I'll do my best to paraphrase. He said, some of us can be likened to dinner plates, getting lots of daily use in the Lord's service, while others are that gravy dish, the one that only comes out a few times a year. That doesn't make the gravy dish less important. In fact, in some sense, it's more important because it has that special use for which no other can be substituted. And so this is Esther's purpose right here, that special use that no one else can take care of. I would really recommend you read the entirety of reprint 3657. We don't have time to read it. But Brother Russell has a beautiful lesson about the spiritual Israelites and what we should do to use the gifts granted to us by the Lord. And so this is a beautiful picture also of for the way we should approach our difficult decisions. As Esther implored her people to pray and fast for her, it's also good practice for us to consider when faced with difficult decisions today. It doesn't need to be fasting in the sense of avoiding all food. Perhaps instead of fasting, perhaps instead we should fast from those worldly distractions that Brother Arbor mentioned earlier. We should avoid all those things that can consume our time and perhaps eat a more limited diet of entertainment, keep things more spiritual so that our mind gains clarity. And so again, we summarize what happens where Esther approaches the king in Esther 5, and he extends the scepter to her, just like we know. She doesn't get, summoned, or he doesn't sentence her to death. He says, what can I do for you? Even up to half the kingdom, what can I do for you? And she says, come to a banquet I'll make for you. So the king's problem with summarizing is you leave out details. In verse 4 of Esther 5:4, Esther says, if it pleases the king, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet I prepared for him. It's an interesting request. So the king says, absolutely, and Haman goes home thrilled to be a part of this special treat. He feels, Haman, he likes to be noticed. He's invited to a dinner with just the king and the queen. This is stoking his pride. And it's also probably making the king wonder what's going on because she wants something, but she's not telling me. And so they go to this feast, and again, the king says, what can I do for you? Sorry, I'm running out of time here, so I'm skipping around a little bit. So why does Esther have one banquet where she doesn't really tell the king anything, and then another banquet following it? Why does she spread it out like this? We would suggest that it's just to get his attention. She's playing difficult and mysterious, and he's wondering what's going on. And it seems to work, because that night between the banquets, he has a sleepless night. And interestingly enough, during this sleepless night, what do you do when you're having trouble sleeping? Well, let's have the annals read to the king. Read me the reports. That'll put me to sleep. And in the middle of all this, what does he find out? Mordecai saved him. Oh, I forgot about that. What did we ever do for this Mordecai fellow? Nothing. We should do something special for Mordecai. So he looks around, who can I get some advice for, what to do for Mordecai, and who's walking in the front door this morning but Haman. He says, Haman, what should I do for the one that I want to honor more than anyone else? And this is Haman, who just feels amazing about himself right now, and he says, oh, he's talking about me. You should put him on your best horse and clothe him in your best garments and parade him around the city. And the king says, excellent, go do this for Mordecai. This is where the twist comes in. Can you imagine Haman, his mortal enemy, no one he hates more? For a moment there, Haman is on cloud nine. He's invited to a special meal with the king and queen. He's already made plans, which I kind of skipped over, for the hanging of Mordecai. And he's coming in the morning, and he thinks the king is about to honor him, and in a moment, everything twists on him. And now his world is upside down, and he has to honor his mortal enemy. He can't kill him anymore. Not after parading him around the city in the king's clothing on the back of a horse. He just had to honor him. Everything is different. And it only gets worse, because as you know, they go to the second banquet, and the king says, what can I do for you, Esther? And then she says, there's a viciousness being perpetrated against my people, and it's this evil Haman. And the king flies into a rage. Haman throws himself at her feet, and in the process, the king thinks he's assaulting her, and that's the end of it for Haman, and he is executed. I could only describe it as emotional whiplash. Haman was going one way, and everything came crashing down around him. Now, of course, we really are lacking in time, so I'm going to summarize a lot here. But we know that even though Haman's gone, that's not even the end of it. There's still an edict with the law of the Medes and the Persians saying that all these Jews are going to be killed. How do you solve this problem? You can't retract that. And this is where I think the Spirit of the Lord gives a beautiful answer. They bring in Mordecai as an advisor, and he says, well, let's do this instead. Arm the Jews and tell them they're now allowed to protect themselves. So the law is, the Jews can be slain on this day, but good luck to you, because I'm going to arm them and let them protect themselves. Brilliant solution without violating the law of the Medes and the Persians. So many wonderful lessons here. One is that the Lord can turn defeat into victory through means we cannot guess. And this should be a comfort and encouragement to us through times of trial. We don't truly need to see a way out if He's with us. Combine this with our previous lessons, we ought to be constantly aware of when our position or our talents place us in a circumstance to be of service to the Lord and do with all our might what our hands find to do. And while we ought to be aware of what we do and why and do our best to anticipate His will, we don't necessarily need to have the answer to every problem or an entire plan in mind. We just need to be willing and to be faithful. And so we want to encourage each of you to draw on the lessons you find most applicable to your own personal walk. Remember that we all have a role, though at many points in our lives it's not clear what that role might be or when we might be used. But when He has a need of us, He'll let us know. And there's no shame in being that gravy dish brought out only at special need. There's no shame at being that dinner plate. We should simply be patient and pleased to be used in His service. And so let us remember several of these lessons to regulate our tempers, to not puff ourselves up with pride. Let us remember that He can accomplish great victories out of the jaws of apparent defeat. So we hope you found some motivation to study these things for yourselves. And again, I would encourage you to do so and to listen to the recordings of Brothers Hagensek, Migaz, also Brother David Rice has a talk that I came across. So many wonderful thoughts to share. And may the Lord add his blessing.